You're tuned to Perspectives, a weekly public affairs show which airs every Saturday right here on KTEP. And joining us on Perspectives today is Dan Jones. Dan is a best-selling, award-winning historian of the Middle Ages. He is the author of Summer Blood, A History of the Peasants' Revolt of 1381, and The Plantagenets, The Warrior Kings and Queens Who Made England, a number one international bestseller, which is turning into a four-part television series due to be released next year. He has written and narrated several other documentaries, including one on great British castles, and is currently working on a book on 1215, the year of the Magna Carta. And he also is a columnist for the Evening Standard, a graduate of Cambridge University, where he was a star student of David Starkey. He lives in London, as I mentioned, but he also is working on two television series based on the best-selling book The Plantagenets and another series entitled The Great British Castles. Dan, you are a busy man.
But it's great to take the time out to speak to you. So, yeah, no, it's been really, really interesting. I've been traveling around the States for the last couple of weeks, talking to people about the new book, about the Wars of the Roses. And I have to say, I've been really impressed with how much enthusiasm and how much knowledge there is of this period in America right now.
Dan, the name of the novel is actually The Wars of the Roses, The Fall of the Plantagenets and the Rise of the Tudors. Why is it that there seems to be a lot of interest around this time period or this genre, this era, people talking about knights, castles, dragon slayers, fantasy games, all that stuff?
It's really interesting, isn't it? And when I was studying, it was all about the Tudors. It was Tudors, 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 and you couldn't move from reading books, seeing television documentaries, seeing the big Showtime series about the Tudors. And personally, because I have a great interest in the Middle Ages, it's great to see people moving over to a different dynasty. These things go in trends. Now, I think there are three things that have really brought this period into the popular kind of culture, if you like, at the moment. There's The White Queen, which is the show based on Philippa Gregory's novels, which Starz made, which has dramatized The Wars of the Roses. There's Game of Thrones, which is hugely popular, the HBO series set in a sort of alternative fantasy medieval universe. And there was a great news story, which you might remember from a couple of years back, where they dug up the lost skeleton of Richard III, the last Plantagenet king. And these things kind of combined, I think they're getting people interested in the Middle Ages, often through a sort of fictional perspective, but that I find leads people on to want to know, hey, what was the real history behind this? And that's what I'm aiming to do with my books.
What about C.S. Lewis's books, especially The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe? If you read the entire series, at the beginning, you know, they're talking about knights and princes, Prince Caspian. They sort of mix in a little bit of the Middle Ages and the kings, queens, and of course, there's the Wicked Queen. But that got children interested. And now, as you mentioned, it's not just young people, it's adults who are getting enthralled into this pop culture. And it's great because it's getting people to read.
I totally agree. You know, someone was mentioning C.S. Lewis to me when I was giving a talk the other night. And of course, I was reminded that Lewis was a scholar with a great interest in the Middle Ages. That fed into his fiction. We could look at another one of those great dons who wrote very, very popular fantasy fiction novels, J.R.R. Tolkien, you know, throwing in a lot of his knowledge of kind of a more ancient period of early medieval British history into his novels. The way I look at it is this. More people read historical fiction than read history because often it's more accessible, it's better written, and people just feel more comfortable with getting into a story in which there's a sort of conscious plot put on it and which the quality of the writing can throw them inside the characters' heads. That sometimes leads people on to reading history. But what I found when I was studying history was that a lot of history had earned its reputation as being sometimes a dull and dusty and dry and difficult subject, and the books were not written in an accessible way. And what I've tried to do in writing my novels and writing my history books, The Plantagenets and The Wars of the Roses, is start from a base of rigorous historical research, familiarity with the latest historical arguments, and, you know, I'm in the archives, I'm looking at the original records, I'm building these are history books, but on top of that, I want to bring a style of writing that is fluent, that is accessible, that you could read if you were an intelligent, 9 or 10 year old, you could enjoy if you were a knowledgeable 109, 110 year old, you know, that these books are accessible and that they're sort of scholarly. That combination of the two disciplines has been really important to me in approaching history, because I don't want people to be put off history and just read historical fiction. I want them to come from historical fiction to history and enjoy what they read just as much.
We are visiting with Dan Jones. Dan is the New York Times bestselling author of The Plantagenets and also his most recent book, The Wars of the Roses, The Fall of the Plantagenets and the Rise of the Tudors. Dan, first of all, am I pronouncing that word correctly? Is it Plantagenet or it depends on part of the country?
Now we tend to say Plantagenet, but of course you're closer in your pronunciation to the original, because Plantagenet, the word comes from the founder of the dynasty, Geoffrey of Anjou, who was said always to wear, this is back in the 12th century, by the way, who was said always to wear a sprig of broom blossom in his hat, yellow flower. Now the Latin name for broom is Plantagenister. That came into the French because, of course, all these noblemen in the time I'm talking about spoke French. So Plantagenet or Plantagenet, you know, and that then became hardened into an anglicized form, Plantagenet. But either works.
You talked about historical fiction a little while ago, Dan, and recently we interviewed, I guess it was last year, maybe even the year before, we interviewed American author Steve Barry, who wrote The King's Deception, and it was about the Tudors. And because of that, as you mentioned, people get interested because he kind of makes it contemporary, and then he goes back into the Tudor age, and then he goes back to contemporary. And so because it's a story and it flows, people tend to pick up, after they finish reading that novel, they'll go and look up stuff about the Tudors, and they want to learn more about that era.
Yeah, I think that's a path that a lot of people follow, you know. You get into novels of any era, and that then leads you on to start reading about the history. You know, I for example, my interest in American history, in modern American 20th century history, was sparked by reading the novels of James Ellroy, you know, who was the crime writer turned great chronicler of American underworld, American conspiracy in the 1960s, 1970s. And reading the American Underworld trilogy by Ellroy, which is full of kind of historical conspiracy theory and period slang, and it's kind of this wild ride. That was kind of my entry point, and now I'm kind of getting more interested in modern American history because, of course, you can't live in the Middle Ages forever. I do my research in the Middle Ages. I like to read another period. So that's a path I think so many people follow. You get into the fiction, and then you say to yourself, okay, let's find out a little more about what really happened. And I think most people are often pleasantly surprised that when they get into the history, it's just as entertaining, it's just as exciting, it's just as riveting as sometimes the fiction that's set in that period is as well.
As an historian yourself, how do people get involved as far as finding out more about history, about like you learning about America and people here not realizing that England is our mother country? And yet we really, most of us only know a little bit about King George, the American Revolution, and that's it.
It's interesting you bring up that point, because I've said to a couple of people when I've had conversations as I've been traveling around the States, you know, this isn't history that's owned by Brits. You know, this we are from a shared history of monarchy, and I find in the United States there are a lot of people with a deep fascination with royalty, but who feel like this is somehow alien to their own history. And I say, well, you know, it's not really. It was funny. We're part of the shared tradition, and this all our histories converge if you look backwards into this long line of kings and the Wars of the Roses and the Plantagenets and so on. But it's funny. I was when Prince George, you know, the youngest member of the royal family, William and Kate's little son, was born a couple of years ago. I was down at the hospital in London, and I met a couple of American tourists. You know, I was standing doing media stuff, and I met a couple of American tourists, and we struck up conversation. They were telling me how fascinated they were with royal history, with the royal family. And I said, meaning it as a joke, well, wouldn't it be great if you had a king and queen in America? And they said, yeah, we would love that. I said, I think there was a point when all that stuff diverged. But, you know, it's great that people want to get into this period and want to explore this often quite quite alien world of knights and princes and kings and queens and all this stuff that happened 500, 600, 700 years ago.
We're visiting with Dan Jones. Dan is the author of The Wars of the Roses, The Fall of the Plantagenets, and The Rise of the Tudors. Dan, in your book, you describe the crown of England changed hands 5 times over the course of the 15th century. That's incredible.
So this is what we have in the course of the 15th century is, and I begin the book in 1420 at the high point of medieval kingship, okay? Henry V, the great hero of Agincourt, if you know your Shakespeare history plays, the great hero of medieval English history, had just secured, via the Treaty of Troyes, he'd just secured the crown of France as well. This is what England had been fighting for a century. It's the high point of the Plantagenet story. But then there came this very rapid collapse. Over the course of 60, 70 years, the whole Plantagenet dynasty just sort of fell in on itself. And the crown changing hands 5 times, I mean, that happened within a 15-year burst of violence where the crown just went back and forth and back and forth. And battle after battle was killing off more and more of these families until you get to the Battle of Bosworth in 1485, and there's really only one man left standing. It's Henry Tudor, who was, by the way, half Welsh, half French, not really any decent candidate for kingship at all, but there he was in 1485, putting the crown on his head and becoming King of England. This should never have happened, but it did. So it's an incredibly dramatic story with great turns along the way.
When you mention characters, a lot of people are familiar with Henry VIII, Richard III, and you tell us about these characters, and if people want to find out more about these characters and what they actually stood for, as you mentioned, Henry Tudor should have never received that crown. Well, people asking, well, why is that wrong? What do I need to find out more? What do I not know? Tell us a little bit more about what people should go in when they dive into this book, War of the Roses.
So what I've written my books to be for people who let's say, have heard of this period, are curious, but they assume no knowledge. So if you have lots of knowledge, you'll go to this book and go, oh, okay, there's some interesting new perspectives on this history. But that you don't have to have that. I've written this book for people who are just purely interested, and you're going to get from it character sketches of the key people involved, a simple and clear kind of breakdown of how the politics evolved over this period. It's got all the maps, it's got the family tree, so you can find your place in history, you can find the place in the country. You don't need a knowledge of British geography or that kind of thing. But what I've also put in the book is an extensive bibliography. So if you've got, let's say, I know a lot of people come up to me and say, hey, I've been researching my family tree and I found out that I'm related to a kind of Plantagenet king of sort of 17, 18 generations ago. Well, there's a long list of books, of web resources, because so much more of this material is being put on the internet, by the way. You know, I work out of London, England, and I can sit at my laptop, and so many books from American libraries, manuscripts from libraries in France, in America, all across the world, wherever they've ended up, have now been digitized, and you can read them on your laptop in high resolution. So as well as telling the story, showing people clearly stage by stage how it all happened, I'm kind of giving them the resources to go and find out more about this history and follow it in any direction they want to go with it.
Dan, can you recap the War of the Roses and who were the Plantagenets and who were the Tudors?
So the Plantagenet family is a very, very long-running dynasty that begins back in the 12th century. And over the course of sort of 8 generations up to the 14th century, this is 1399 now, they'd established themselves as the great English royal dynasty. They had ruled an empire that encompassed half of France, the whole western seaboard of France, that stretched from the borders of Scotland in the north down to the Pyrenees, that's between France and Spain in the south. Little by little, they'd lost most of that French kingdom, but they were well established as the great ruling royal dynasty in England. Now, we come to the 15th century, and there's been, you know, one king, Richard II, has been deposed by his cousin, but his son, Henry V, has become the great hero of Agincourt, and it looks like everything is back on course and everything's going to be fine. And, you know, Henry V was adored at home. He was very adept at settling political crises at home. He was a wonderful soldier, but he died. He died very suddenly in his 30s at a siege. He died of a soldier's disease, dysentery. And he left behind him, as his heir, as king, a 9-month-old baby whom he'd never met because he'd been away on campaign when his wife gave birth back in England. And this is the start of a disastrous period in English monarchy, because this baby grows up and all the nobles in England make a concerted effort to hold government and the war together while the baby grows up to become a man. But when this baby, Henry VI, becomes a man, it becomes obvious, very, very clear, very, very early, that he's not cut out to be a king. He can't fight. They'll never send him to lead an army. He's just not capable. He is very weak and vacillating and is not very good at making political decisions. He's sort of governed, really, by other people. And slowly but surely, under this very, very weak and sort of placid rule, the war effort collapses in France, and political order starts to fall apart at home. Barons start fighting and feuding with each other, and these feuds aren't stamped out. Little by little, order dissolves, and every time, and so what you have is a series of people trying to manage government for the king, but you have rivalries developing around him, and little by little, this all builds up. There's a huge amount of political pressure, and then in 1453, the king goes mad. He goes into a state of catatonia, in which he can't eat, he can't recognize anybody, he doesn't recognize his wife when she comes to see him, he can't communicate. And this really is too much for the country, a country under 30 years of pressure to bear, and it erupts into a series of battles between rivals for political influence. And that then spins in the 1460s into a series of conflicts, because one of the main protagonists in this argument, Richard, Duke of York, decides he's going to claim the crown for himself. So you have two rival royal families, the House of York and the House of Lancaster, representing the king, King Henry VI and his wife. And these families battle it out until the House of York, the sort of upstarts, emerge on top. But that's not the end of it, because then within the House of York, you have a series of internal rivalries and fights and skirmishes and battles. And this then goes on and on and on until the 1480s. And it's with huge, huge, violent, terrible battles, like the Battle of Towton, 1461, where 28,000 men are killed in a single day. Battle of Tewkesbury, where where Prince Edward, the heir to the throne on the Lancastrian side, is slaughtered. Battle of Barnet, fought in the fog, where Warwick the Kingmaker, another famous name, is killed. By the time you get to the 1480s, whole aristocratic families are just totally wiped out. And you end up with this sort of political footnote, really, a young man called Henry Tudor, who's been on the fringes of all of this, half Welsh, half French, he's been living in exile in France, who comes to England, seizes the crown at the Battle of Bosworth, and establishes the Tudor dynasty, which you will all have heard of, because it becomes the most famous dynasty in English royal history.
Why War of the Roses? How did flowers become symbolic? You mentioned earlier about, I guess, one of the kings, was it, that used to wear the flower?
Right, well, Count Geoffrey of Anjou, okay. Right back in the early history, Geoffrey of Anjou had worn broom blossom in his hair. This was more than 300 years ago by the time we got to the 15th century. Now, the Wars of the Roses is a very misleading term in some ways, because no one in the 15th century saw it as a War of the Roses. The House of York used a white rose as one of their badges, but there were others. They used the falcon and fetterlock. They used the sun in splendor. The House of Lancaster, traditionally, we think of as associated with the red rose. But that was not the case for much of the wars, because the red rose just wasn't a symbol of the House of Lancaster. It was only made so after the Tudors had come into power in the 1480s, because they needed to look back and convince people of the reason for their being, their ruling England. And they did that in a very clever way, which was to say, this war was about one thing. It was about two sides of the same family at feud, at war. And we, the Tudors, knitted them back together and saved the country. And that was all summed up in one very simple symbol, the Tudor rose, which was red and it was white. Now, to make that Tudor rose, they had to create the idea of the red rose versus the white rose, but that was really quite artificial and really a creation of the 1480s that became popular after the main battles of the war had finished. Because when this stuff was going on, it was much more complex, and the rivalries were more complex, the alliances were shifting and changing. It was really not as simple as Tudor histories would later make it appear. But it's a mark of the success of those Tudor histories, that we still use the Wars of the Roses to as shorthand for this series of very devastating and complicated battles in the 15th century. It's a mark that the Tudors really did win. They won the military war, and they won the, if you like, the propaganda war as well.
We are visiting with Dan Jones. Dan is a best-selling, award-winning historian of the Middle Ages. His most recent book is The Wars of the Roses, The Fall of the Plantagenets, and The Rise of the Tudors. Dan, during this time period, and you discuss in your book, that was around the time the printing press came around, and so what significance did that play as far as all of this, the campaigning and the bloodshed and getting the word out?
Yeah, well, the 15th century is a big a time of change, and a lot of it to do with the written word and the printed word, as you say. What I start with in The Wars of the Roses is I show that in France, when the Plantagenets were fighting there and claiming to be kings of France, they were scattering all over the country poems, family trees, which were, we would call them propaganda. You know, they were arguing a very one-sided case, saying the kings of England are also the rightful kings of France, and they were advertising this everywhere. Skip forward 80 years, and the Tudors were doing exactly the same thing. They were advertising, when histories of England were printed up using the printing press in the 16th century, you could now print lots of copies, and you could print the same designs on them. So we have a text from 1550, Grafton's edition of Hall's Chronicle, very, very famous history of the time. It inspired indirectly Shakespeare's plays. If you look at the front page of that, what's printed on there is this wonderful family tree showing the House of Lancaster and the House of York, and all the main characters are sitting in the branches of a rose bush, and the roses eventually intertwine at the top in the form of Henry VIII, one of the Tudors. This was not how the wars really went, but it was absolutely consistent with Tudor propaganda. Only now, because you have the ability to print mechanically, they were able to create a lot more copies of this. So the rise of printing the increase of the printed and the written word, really, during the 15th century, all played into the ability in the 16th century of people to spin how and what these wars had been.
And you mentioned in your book also that not only was the press and all that had something to do with as far as getting the printed word out, but this was also the high point of the Age of Chivalry.
Well, absolutely. I mean, this is the whole Plantagenet period sees a sort of a rise in or an emphasis on importance of knightly forms of behavior. So this is, in a sense, quite a romantic time. You know, when I was writing the Plantagenets, we had sort of great warrior knights such as William Marshall, who was around at the time of Bad King John and the Magna Carta and all that. And you had the Black Prince, who was fighting in the early days of the Hundred Years' War. And you have some of the same characters here as well. You know, the one of the maternal uncles of Edward V, who was one of the princes in the Tower, was Earl Rivers. And he was known, he was famous throughout Europe as one of the sort of greatest, most honorable knights around. You know, he was very literate. He's sort of very interested in books. He published books, but he also was given the great honor when a particular Burgundian nobleman came to visit the court of Edward IV. Rivers, this was before he was older, same person, Rivers was given the honor of fighting a series of public battles, public tournament battles, against this great visiting nobleman. So you have these wonderful scenes of men of the highest rank kind of doing battle on the public stage for the public's entertainment, not fighting to the death, but fighting with every ounce of their sort of might and their strength. So that adds a lot of color, and I suppose ultimately people will find a lot of romance in the Middle Ages from that point of view.
At the beginning of the book, you have a quote here from Richard II, William Shakespeare. "For God's sake, let us sit upon the ground and tell sad stories of the death of kings, how some have been deposed, some slain in war, some haunted by the ghosts they have deposed, some poisoned by their wives, some sleeping killed, all murdered for within the hollow crown that rounds the mortal temples of a king, keeps death his court." That's a powerful beginning to a book, and the book hasn't even started yet.
That's one of my favorite quotations from all of Shakespeare, actually, and it comes from the play Richard II, and this is a point where Richard is locked up in the tower. What's interesting about that particular quote from Richard II is that Shakespeare was drawing on history books which went back to a source, Adam of Usk, a chronicler of the time, who'd actually been in the tower with the real Richard II while he was giving a very similar speech. Richard was locked up, and Adam of Usk went with one of the sort of noblemen. They were having dinner with Richard. And Adam of Usk writes down in his chronicle, which is basically like his diary, his journal, he says, and it was very sad, you know, we went to see Richard II, poor old Richard was locked up, having been kicked off the throne, and he was very miserable, and after dinner he started to discourse dolefully on the history of England and how it had, you know, time after time had ruined and killed its kings. And Shakespeare takes this eyewitness account, indirectly because it's been fed through Hall and Hollinger and other historians, but Shakespeare takes this account and transforms it and gives it this amazing rendering in verse, you know, within the hollow crown that rounds the mortal temples of the king. Now, those weren't Richard II's real words, but they're a beautiful poetic rendering of a scene that we know absolutely did happen. But there's another quote at the beginning of the book, which is a popular saying of the mid-15th century, and it's just two lines, but I think this gives you the other side of the Wars of the Roses, the side that wasn't versified by Shakespeare. And it simply says, "Who what now?" That means who knows now. "Who what now? Who is here? Where he will be another year." And it just, that just sums up what people really felt going through these wars. Year to year, day to day, month to month, no one knew what was going to happen next.
Dan, thank you very much for taking the time out of your busy schedule to visit with us and giving us that brief history lesson and guiding us through this historic tour. Thank you so much. We have been visiting with Dan Jones. Dan is the New York Times bestselling author of The Plantagenets. Most recent work is The Wars of the Roses, The Fall of the Plantagenets, and The Rise of the Tudors. You can find out more information by going to danjoneshistory.com. Perspectives is taped and produced at the KTB Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer, Norman Martinez. You've been tuned to Perspectives. I'm Dewey Science.